Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
Oh, December of 1954. As a matter of fact, I think it was just before Christmas. And within 6 months, there were imitations of the show all over the country. In Seattle, it was Brakeman Bob. In Chicago, it was this, that, the other thing. And there's no way that you can protect an idea. And it was a perfectly legitimate compliment, you know. Mm-hmm. Good enough, so we'll do it too. As a matter of fact, Johnny Downs did it in San Diego, 6 months after we started.
Mm. And so his name of his show was?
What did he call it? Johnny Downs Express or Special or some such thing as that.
And they all were similars in yours, that they had yes, a train set.
Yes, that's right. They all did the train routine. Here's my first. There's Skipper Frank before he even was Skipper Frank.
Hmm.
He started doing a show, the Magic Show on KTLA.
Magic Party.
Magic Party, yeah. And he asked me if I'd come over and help him one day, and I did. And believe me, that was before either one of us had created the characters that we got most of our recognition for.
Well, how did you start out? Were you an actor, or?
Well, I had been in radio since 1933. So I worked at KOA in Denver. I was an announcer, writer, and production. And then after 5 years, I came out here and went to work for KFI. And I was, oh Lord, this is before you were born.
Oh yes, I was 25 years old, to give you an idea.
Well, that's long before you were born.
Yeah,
I came out to KFI, and incidentally, KFI at the time that I came out in 1939 was known as the radio station to get a job in, because it was a fine base from which you could operate and audition for network shows and so on and so forth. So I came out and went to work for KFI from Colorado. They didn't invite me out. I just quit my job in Denver and came out. And in a matter of 3 or 4 weeks, I went to work for KFI as a summer relief announcer, and then I stayed. And within 6 months, I had a network show, Those We Love, for Standard Brands with Nan Gray and Donald Woods. It was a nighttime soap opera show. Mm-hmm. And then a year later, I got the Rudy Valley show when John Barrymore was the co-star on it. And then the war came along and things blew up and we all went off and did our jobs and came back and started anew. Because everything had changed, except that the job at KFI was still there.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of going network then, or trying to be a network coast-to-coast radio announcer, I started to write for myself and create shows for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I started Ladies Day on KFI, which was a radio show.
Were ladies call in?
It was with Bob Mitchell. We called it Ladies Day. It was a salute to the ladies at home. And it was fun and music and poetry, and it was just keeping them company at home while mm-hmm. they were doing all of their chores. And that developed...
Dine a shore kind of program.
Yeah. And we did that from 46... to 52. That was 6 years. But meanwhile, television came along. And Earl C. Anthony applied for a television license, and he got it. It's the original Channel 9, KFI, mm-hmm. Channel 9, which is now KHJ.
KHJ.
Yeah. And so we got a television license. Now what do we do? And I was working radio, and I was staff announcer, and I was doing extra shows and making extra money, and I didn't pay much attention to television until my wife said, "Bill, you've got to get into television." And I said, "Ruth, no way." I said, "Short, fat, balding, there's no room for me in television." She said, "Of course there is." She said, "Go get a toupe and get in on the thing while nobody knows what's going on and learn along with them." And this was the best advice anybody had ever
given. But you never had to do that. Go out and get a toupee, did you?
Yes, I did.
You actually wore one in the program?
I actually wore a toupee, yeah. As a matter of fact, where's the parlor party thing? There's one. It doesn't look like it. It wasn't.
Sure doesn't.
It wasn't an obvious one, but it sure covered up some. For instance,
you must have.
Look at the comparison. That's what my hairline looks like. That almost now.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it's a family trait.
And yeah, yeah, me too. See.
Yeah.
That's the way. I have three brothers. They all have the same eye forelines.
So. We started in television in 1948. I think it was the month of August. I say August because that was the first time that KFI television went daytime across the board with programming.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the television stations that started
would go on
in the evening for 3 or 4 hours. And as a matter of fact, we did our time in the evening too, because we used to do a show. I remember Cliffy Stone and Tennessee Ernie Ford were doing this show out in El Monte or someplace. Well, we did a visit to Azusa and Covina and so on and so forth, and saluted the communities and had the mayor on, and this was at night.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we got our indoctrination. But then we started in daytime television, and the Ladies' Day show became, it was the four B's is what it was when we started. And then it became the Ladies' Day show on television. And we were on for 48, 49, 50, 51. And then there was a strike that Earl C. Anthony never settled. He was so anti-union. He wouldn't settle it, and instead he sold the station to General Tire and Rubber. But because of the strike, we left the station and went to KNBH, and we had to change the name of the show from Ladies' Day to Parlor Party, and so we were there for 2 years. And then we went back to Channel 9. We were there for, well, let's see, 52. I started Engineer Bill in 54. We did the one-hour Parlor Party show concurrently with the Engineer Bill show for a year and a half.
Mm.
So I had
two one-hour shows
per day on
television.
Were
they back to back, or did you have
no? They weren't. One was in the afternoon, and the Engineer Bill show started in prime time, 6 to 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you get the idea for the Engineer Bill and
well,
all that?
Sheriff John had started, and he was quite successful, and so. As is still true in television, the Imitation Complex hit KHJ, so they decided they would buy a package of cartoons and they would audition for a character, and they already had the name picked for him, Ranger Ed. So when you've been thinking creatively about building programs and so on and so forth, even though they were for yourself, there's sort of a little thing that the little cards drop in place when something hits your head.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute they said cartoons, I thought of trains because I'd been a hobbyist,
mm-hmm.
an HO hobbyist, and I loved trains.
Yeah,
train stories. Yeah. And so I went upstairs. I remember it was Howard Wheeler, who was sales manager, and John Reynolds, who became president of CBS, was the general manager of KSJ. And I told him, I said, I wanted to I wanted to audition for this show with the cartoons. And Howard Wheeler looked at me and he said, oh God, he said, don't tell him. He said, you'd look like hell as Ranger Head. And I said, I agree. I said, but that isn't what I was thinking of. And John Reynolds was there too. And he says, well, what were you thinking of? He said, I've got an idea for a railroad show for kids. I'm an engineer. I'm Engineer Bill. Do you know, being in the right place at the right time, with the right idea is the whole secret.
Yeah.
These guys stopped and looked at each other. 5 minutes of discussion, and they cut off all the interviews. Everything was finished. We're going to do it. Howard said, now my kid's got a Lionel set at home. And John Reynolds said, I think we've got some at home too. And I said, well, I'll find some. Now here's a very ironic thing. We called, as a matter of fact, I called the Lionel Train Corporation. And I asked to
see what's coming up.
I asked to talk to the merchandising manager, sales manager. They were one and the same. So I talked to him and I introduced myself and I said, I'm here in Los Angeles and I'm with KHJ TV and we are starting a children's show called Engineer Bill, and we need a train layout. And this was before Christmas. He said, oh God. He said, look, he said, I'm too busy right now. He said, call me after Christmas, will you? So I hung up on him and I said, I will never call this man. He missed an opportunity to get some 10 years of free advertising for Lionel Trains. So we started out with this misfit Lionel thing that we put together, and it was simple as can be. Mm-hmm. It really was. It was nothing elaborate. And the representative for American Flyer Trains out here called me up and introduced himself. I'm upset with him. I won't even give you his name. I wouldn't give him name credit. Because he was a very nice guy. But anyway, he was a representative for American Flyer Trains, and he said, hey, he says, I want to introduce myself, and I wanted to ask you, he said, I like the show you're doing. He said, is there anything I can do for you? I said, yes, I need a train layout. And he said, what kind do you want? And I said, well, I'd like to have a two-level. He said, when do you want it? I said, yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, 2 weeks. I said, oh, gee, that'd be great. Do you know that man didn't even call his home office to find out if he could do it or not? He went around to every dealer that he was doing business with and asked them if they had any leftover equipment from Christmas and so on and so forth. And they said yes, and he'd write him a credit memo and take the merchandise. And he took it to a guy who built the layout in 2 weeks and delivered it to the station. And on they went, American Flyer. They had done zilch business prior to their appearance on the show. And the following year, they did $400,000 in trains in American Flyer Trains.
Yeah.
So you see, other people miss opportunities too. This sales manager was so busy with his own tiny little problems, he couldn't grasp what we meant.
Sure.
When all we wanted was, what, at that time, $150 worth of trains or something and a layout. That's all it would have cost. But anyway, here I am rambling.
That's fine. That's where my best information comes
from. I'm really just rambling. Reminiscing is more to the point.
That's what I love about these meetings.
This was, gee, the, I know it has nothing to do with children's shows or anything, but the start of television was such a wonderful experience for everybody who, I don't care what city they were in or what station they worked at, but if they were starting, my very first experience with television, believe it or not, was when, right after the war started, it was in 1940, I knew I was going to be drafted because I was single. And I wanted to pick my branch of service. And I had been working at KFI and reading Signal Corps announcements, you know, promos, and please, if you have a ham license, if you have this or that, write to the Signal Corps officer and get a choice assignment. So I wanted to be in the Signal Corps because I was in radio, and I also had a feel for the technical side of radio. So I wrote to the, I went down to the recruiting station to enlist in the Signal Corps, and they turned me down because of my eyesight. And I got a, I was so mad, I went back to the station, I wrote a letter on KFI stationery to the chief signal officer in Washington, and I said, here I stand reading these stupid announcements about join the Signal Corps, and I went down to join the Signal Corps, and they turned me down because of my eyesight. I said, I can, I've got 20/20 vision with glasses, and I swear, it must have come by special military plane because it was seemed like 24 hours before I get back this letter from the chief Signal Corps officer with a big red band on it, as they do in Washington. Addressed, it was a copy of a letter addressed to the recruiting office here, enlist this man immediately, which they did. But it was a special program that I was very pleased with, and it was an enlisted, Signal Corps Enlisted Men's Reserve Corps. So then I started to go to school. I worked at KFI, I went to Frank Wiggins Trade School, and started in on technical radio. Mm-hmm. And there was a Russian boy there who had quite a, an engineering background in Russia. And he'd been over here a few years. And he had built a television set. It was just rudimentary on a chassis, you know, no cabinet or anything, a small, small tube. And he loaned it to me one day, one weekend. And I took it to my girlfriend's house on Alta Vista Street in Hollywood. And I ran just a single wire antenna up the wall. They were experimenting at Mount Wilson then. Mm-hmm. That's the experimental station that became Channel 2 on Mount Wilson. And I hooked up this thing, and she and I were sitting there watching a jiu-jitsu match. It wasn't karate then, it was jiu-jitsu. And that was my first experience with television in 1940, a set that I had hooked up by myself. And
yeah, it's pretty exciting.
It really was exciting.
It's a miracle.
I couldn't believe it. I said, look at what they're doing. They're sending pictures through the air. Well, who? I never would have believed, you know. Anyway, after the war came the chance to get into television, and it was such fun. It really, nobody knew what they were doing. They had, oh, there were a few guys who had been in it for 6 months, and they were the experts. And you just bowed low and listened to everything they said, mm-hmm. until all of a sudden they started to experiment. And then the directors wanted to get special effects. When I think of the electronic effects they do now on television, it's unbelievable. They can have a singer singing with herself, to herself, anything. And the biggest trick, the first big trick, was to put a Dixie cup on the lens so you could isolate just a head, you know, and super it on another picture, mm-hmm. and everything. And it was so exciting. And television commercials were selling for $25 a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, look, when we started, there were...
People didn't have that many.
There were 65,000 television sets in the county of Los Angeles, not the city, the county of Los Angeles. And we used to read the Radio Dealer's Digest every week or month, whenever it came out, to find out. And they would report how many television sets they had sold. Mm-hmm. And this is the way we were keeping track of the growth of the industry. And of course, I don't know.
There were no ratings.
Maybe I was not as bright technically as I thought I was, but I thought, gee, it's great, it's marvelous. But you know, there'll never be any network television because it's a line of sight thing, and no way can they. And then here they go with their coaxial cable across the country. And now, of course, the satellites,
yeah.
They bounce the pictures off, and you can get them any hour of the day or night from anywhere in the world.
You go in supermarkets, and they're...
That's right, they're yeah.
Yeah.
And but they paid $25 a minute, and you got to know the sponsor, and you liked him, and he had a good product, and you could have fun with it. So the commercials would be 3 minutes or 4 minutes, but they were all part of the entertainment of the show because we just kicked them around and had such fun with them. It was unbelievable. There was a little fellow, his first name was Louis, and I've forgotten his last name, but he was the most marvelous pitch man that I ever heard in my life. And he sold a product called Feimster's Magic Slicer, and it sold for $1, and I still have it. I'm going to go get it for you. May I?
Yeah, sure.
All right. This, let's see, 1948, 78. This is 30 years ago.
The first Vegematic.
Yeah.
Miracle Slicer.
This is 30 years ago, and it cost $1. And we don't have a Cuisinart, but we can do everything that we can do on the Cuisinart, except it takes longer. And the amazing thing is this. He sold, let's see, the first year that he was on, it's patented. And here it is. You can adjust it for French fries, or you can adjust it for good thick slices of cabbage or anything. $1.
That's pretty good.
And he sold 350,000 of them the first year that he was on television doing his pitch. And he had a beautiful big tray with it. Oh, it was so gorgeously laid out. And he would do a sing-song pitch as he's slicing things, and I thought, oh, he's not going to have any fingers left when he gets finished. But his pitch was so beautiful, he sold 350,000 of them in a year, and his net, absolute net after mailing and everything, was 30 cents per copy. So this was a nice year's income. But 2 years ago, I was in a store, and I saw one of those, and I said, how much is it? And I looked at it, and it was exactly the same quality, and the man said, $1.29.
Wow.
Now, in 28 years, to have increased the cost only 29 amazing. Cents is absolutely amazing in this world of inflation.
It really is. That's interesting.
Gee, I'm...
Makes you want to go invent something like that.
Yes, it does. It really does.
Have your own product.
I'm bogged down. Where are we now?
Okay. I would like to start right now on what was your first show like? You got the train set in.
Got the train set in, and the first show, I was shaky. The director was shaky. The crew was shaky. We had an idea, but we really didn't have a show. We had cartoons, and I was there, and I was...
Remember the cartoons you first had?
Oh, yeah, they were really raunchy.
Remember what they were?
Believe me, they were every bit as bad as Little Black Sambo and things like this. They were so racist and so terrible, mm-hmm. It was... unbelievable.
Well, a lot of the old Looney Tunes and that kind of stuff.
Terrible.
Still
absolutely
is.
Terrible. You bangy women with their big lips flapping and so on.
As far as I'm concerned, it's worse than it ever was because that's all there is now. They don't even have hosts to break it up.
No.
You know?
But they were really terrible. Bad. It was a cheap batch of dumb cartoons. And I was ashamed of them. I really was.
Mm-hmm.
because I do have respect for the intelligence of children. And I thought, gee, I just can't do this. But I had to do it because that's all there was. And without the cartoons, there was no show. Because if you're in show business, you know that, sure, you can do a hobby show, but you can't intrigue two-year-olds with a hobby show or three-year-olds, you know. It's got to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was the whole thing. So after the first week of the show, I came home, and Ruth and I were sitting having a drink that evening, and I said, Ruth, what do you really think of the show? She said, really and truly? And I said, yes. She said, I think it's a good show. I think the character is okay. You'll develop it further, I'm sure. But she said, Bill, it lacks a gimmick. And I said, what do you mean it lacks a gimmick? She said, just that. I can't explain what I'm saying, but I know in my heart, because she was... Ruth was the producer of the Hollywood Bowl Auditions of the Air for KFI. That's where we met and were married. And and she did, she produced a show with a symphony orchestra and such young, budding talent as Andre Previn and Robert Browning and Bobby Maxwell, the jazz harpist, and so on and so forth. And so she had a good sense of showbiz. She said, it lacks a gimmick. And I said, man, gimmick, what are we going to do? She said, well, she said, do you know that game we play with Kathy when she was a baby about drinking her milk, red light, green light? And I said, yeah. She said, why don't you take Kathy down and introduce that game to the kids? I said, oh, put your own kid on to sit there with egg on her face. She said, she won't sit there with egg on her face.
So drink the milk.
So Ruth went out and bought Kathy a little engineer's outfit and a hat. And the next week she came down on the show, and I introduced her to the kids as my daughter. And we had a game that we played at home, and we'd like them to learn how to play it too. Paul, at that time we lived in Burbank. 2 weeks after, and then Kathy was only on the one night. And then I played the game the next night and the next night and the next night for 2 weeks. And all of a sudden, you began to get the feel of what fun this game is and the things you can do with it. And work it and milk it and what a pun, milk, the red light, green light game. But anyway, I was walking down Magnolia Street in Burbank. It was noontime or thereabouts. And I walked past two grown men. And as soon as I walked past them, I heard someone holler, red light, green light. And I turned around and the guy's waving at me. And do you know, from that day on, I knew that we had something going. They told me on the street that it was catching on. The man, not the child, the man. And that that caught on so fast. And then from there, I was never, well, I had to play a perfect game sometimes, but more often than not, I would miss, because that's what the kids liked when I goofed
up. When you would say yourself, you got a visitor.
Well, that's my wife. Ah, that's my wife. Just a minute. I'll get the door. I'll get the door, Kish, and we'll let the mommy in, huh? Hi there.
Hello.
We have company.
We do?
Yes, we have company.
Hi.
Mr. Paul Maher, Mayer.
Mayer,
we know it as Maher, don't we? Mabel Maher.
No, not related.
Not related.
Oh, you're not.
But it's the same, Mayer.
That's the dog sock.
That's
really,
the dog sock.
Not the
no, I know.
Yes. Oh!
I want you to go look in the garage.
I want you to go look in the garage. It's all straightened out. I don't want to hear any more complaining.
Did you turn it off?
No, it's still rolling.
It's still rolling.
It's all right, because I make a tape of this.
Well, anyway,
tape, so
from then, we realized what we had.
Yeah, you would surprise him in a way that you would say, red light, like almost if you...
Call the signals. The announcer on the show called the signals. There was Freight Train Wayne and Boxcar Bond and Tank Car Ted.
Which never appeared in front of the camera.
They were always off-camera voices.
Yeah.
Off-camera voices, and they would call the signals.
And you got pretty good at it after a while, and occasionally you could...
And I would goof every once in a while.
And bust up laughing at times.
That's right.
Yeah. Because of this crew.
Right, and the crew was at least 50% of the show, because they participated with such glee. They really did. And... You know, when you're doing a show like that, the crew can help you or hint to perform in front of a crew that just gives you the stony stare.
Sure.
You're
bad
dead.
Vibes.
You're dead.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't go on.
Yeah.
And so they were pretty terrific guys.
They probably realized that they had to humor you along, because they didn't.
They were friends.
Yeah.
They were real friends. And...
Now, did you get any response from the Milk Association at all? Or?
No. But 7-Up wanted to sponsor it. Drink 7-Up instead of, or Orange, or any kind of thing. No way.
Yeah.
But the Milk Association just didn't know. They didn't realize. Nothing.
Hmm.
We really didn't want it to be sponsored.
Yeah.
I didn't. The station would have loved it, yeah. But we did it with just as a goodwill thing, you know. Except the mothers didn't think it was such a goodwill thing when the kids would slobber the milk and spill it all over the carpeting and everything. But it turned out to be great. And then we went from there to all of the other good things that children should do, like eat their spinach and be a Sammy Strong Arm by eating all your vegetables, and if you didn't, you were a Freddy Fooey. And then we had the little engine that could. You remember that story? And I built that little thing, and we built an incline for it, and then we'd have a bad habit that we wanted to overcome.
You know, I forgot completely about this until you mention it now. But it all comes back to me.
Sometimes it took us a week to get rid of the bad habit. And this was good psychology, because you can't do it immediately. And we pointed out that, gee, kids, these bad habits we have, you know, they take a lot of work. So every night we'd try, mm-hmm. and Friday night we'd have the bad habit whipped.
And
when the little engine, he'd sink back on Thursday and say, tomorrow I'll do it. Tomorrow I'll do it. And sometimes we did it on Thursday to fool them, so they mm-hmm. wouldn't think everything happened on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
But these were the things that were fun to think of, you know. And then I had that wonderful friend, Frank Webb, who used to be a local television personality here, and he was a cartoonist. And he did cartoons for me of all of these characters my memory is a little vague now, but all of the bad habits he illustrated in cartoons, like the kid who had the new shoes and went to school kicking a can or a rock all the way and ruined his shoes by the time he got to school. And kicking Carl, I think he called him. They were always alliterative names.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such fun to think of all of the good things that you wanted your own child to do. We were all of us raising children at that time, you mm-hmm. know.
How many children do you have?
Skipper Frank had 5. We have 1 daughter.
Mm-hmm. And she's grown up now, but
she's in New York now.
Could appreciate it at the time.
That's right. Yeah. And well, this where I put, she got her. Let's not make too much fuss about it. Anyway, things went on and on and on. And the thing that we didn't realize is, I realized it, and so did a lot of other people, but some people didn't, is that there's a new crop of children every year that grow into your program, mm-hmm. and a crop that leaves it. Mm-hmm. And the age spread was from about 2 to 9 or 10.
So it really doesn't matter when someone says, oh, you're getting old, because...
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. The children are still continuing to come into this earth.
That's right. And this is what program directors found it difficult. I had to fight with these people about, well, gee, you've been doing Red Light, Green Light for 10 years now. I said, yeah. What about it? Well, isn't it getting old? I said, not to the two-year-old that just started drinking out of a glass. I said, it's brand new to him mm-hmm. or her. I said, sure, it's older than the 10-year-old. He's smoking pot now
yeah.
or something. But this...
I think children remain children a little longer in that period of time, too.
Oh, they
grow
up.
You know, they grow up too fast these days.
It's terrible. This is my...
It wasn't anything for me to sit around with my friends at 12 years old and still appreciate you.
That's right.
You know,
now 12 years old, oh, no way. No
and of course,
way.
there's no...
And do you know, it's a sad, sad thing, a very sad thing that children don't have a childhood. Because that is the most carefree period of your life that you'll ever experience, your childhood. And when I say childhood, I mean anywhere from date of birth to 15 years old.
That's right. Yeah.
That, to me, was a childhood when I was growing up.
That was my childhood, too. In fact, yeah. I still have my childhood.
two to 15?
I still have it. It's all right.
But now, 2 to 8? 2 to 7?
Yeah. There was a time when I got to be 13 or 14 years old that I sold off all my puppets that I had, all of the things that were part of my childhood at the swap meet. And now I'm finding I'm buying all that stuff back.
I'm buying it all
I'm
back.
Buying it all, the same thing.
See, you were sort of rebelling against being a child. You were trying to be grown up.
Yeah, yeah.
And the things that you were doing seemed childish to you at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about the song. Did that begin from the very beginning of the show? Was that something?
No, somebody wrote that song. The Engineer Bill song? Mm-hmm. Who's that coming down the track? Yeah. Yeah. That song, I think I used it for about 4 years. Before that, I've forgotten what kind of a railroad theme I had. Just a train sound. Really, it wasn't music. It was a train sound that I had.
I really remember
and
that
And Casey,
yeah.
Casey throwing the mail bag to me, you know, in this garbled voice, and he's yelling at me and everything. And all of the children that came on that show, with the exception of a few professional courtesies that I did, which you have to do, like Kirk Douglas's son and Nanette Fabre's son and some of the other start. I never said who their parents were. Mm-hmm. Never, because this was the kids' moment.
Now, tell me about that for a moment. Did you always have children in the studio, or is that just something that happened now and then?
No. I started the guest thing very, very soon.
Oh, really?
And I would send each of them a miniature car kit to build, an HO kit. Mm-hmm. Dismantled, it had to be assembled, and so on and so forth.
Plastic model train kind of
thing. They weren't plastic then. They became plastic later. Most of them were good metal construction and things like that. You know, mm-hmm. castings.
Things you could, yeah.
Castings. And then they started becoming plastic, and it became much easier for them to do it. But I would send them one of those to build, and then I would say, when you have it ready, just let me know and I'll schedule you on. No, I would send it and tell them they're on the program at such and such a date. Please bring the car with you. Therein also lies a tale. Some of them were done so very well, you knew that Daddy did it. Some of them were done so badly that you knew that they did it. And one little fellow came and he had one that was so bad it was unbelievable. I said, did you or your daddy do this one? He said, oh no, Daddy's secretary did it. And I thought, can you imagine? Daddy brings it to the office and he says, Harriet, I want you to build this thing. The kid's going to be on the show in 2 nights. And I want it finished. Oh, it was really funny. It was a hilarious experience. But somebody asked me on an interview what kind of a show it was. And it was a do-gooder show. No ifs, ands, or buts. We just wanted to do the very best we could to help a child turn out to be, what would we call it, just a straight citizen. Good one. Okay, now it's your turn.
Okay, I have another question about the song still.
We got off that, didn't we?
Do you have the name of a person who wrote it? Do you want to give credit to that person?
Yes, I as a matter of fact, I have a record or two. Would you like one for your collection?
Oh, beautiful.
Huh? Yeah. I'll find one.
Because then
you.
I can just... Yeah. I'd like to include the... if a theme song is... If we have a theme song, I'd like to include the words to it in the book.
Yeah. I'll find one for you. I have one around here somewhere. Okay. From there on, I don't know. It was market appearances on Saturdays, church benefits on Sundays.
Okay. I didn't get this down on tape about this car. Can you mention to me about again? That was
Is it possible to make a copy of this?
I'd love for it to appear. Yeah, I can get a copy of that.
Can you?
Mm-hmm.
After I got to know
You can wait a month.
For a copy of it? Mm-hmm. That's right. But after I got to know the American Flyer representative, I got the idea that I had been a Volkswagen fan for a long time, and I saw the buses. And every time I saw one of those buses, it looked to me like a UP locomotive.
Mm-hmm.
And
the
so
front
I,
windows help.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I tell
all
you.
All those
that,
windows along the side, tiny. And
And split. And so I told him, I said, why don't we ask your company if they'll do this? So he did, and he got it authorized, and we bought a used microbus, and I found
like about a 58 or something like that.
Yeah, and I found this was earlier than that. This was earlier than that. It was about a 55, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found a good body man, and I had an artist sketch what I wanted. And he went to work on that, and I think it took him 2 months to do it. Now, the ports opened in the front so I could have headlights, you know?
Here, yes.
Yeah,
ah.
They opened.
And then the middle one worked as a headlight as well?
Yeah.
It'd be strange to see at nighttime.
And I had underneath that nose a loudspeaker, and I had a record player on the thing, and as I'd approach the personal appearance, I'd put on a record of the diesel sounds, you know?
Yeah.
The diesel train approaching. Mm-hmm. And it worked pretty well. Every once in a while it would jump off, but otherwise it worked pretty well.
You take it pretty slow. And,
yeah.
Because you can't speak in there anyhow.
And it really was quite a sensational thing.
I imagine it would be.
The paint job was magnificent.
It's beautiful, and it's all riveted here.
Yeah, oh, it was
a... And it really resembles a train.
Yes, yeah.
And the horns on top, I take it worked. And
yeah. It was a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Did you ever stand up on top of it? Or
No.
They usually had stages where you went...
Not stages. We were right down on the ground with the kids.
Must
Chucko always worked out of the top of his van.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember.
And he'd throw candy to the kids, but he never got down to shake hands with
them. Yeah.
I was on the ground every minute.
And did you work with an assistant that would help you?
I had an assistant who went ahead of me by about a half hour, and would set up ropes, get things in line. Parents would help, except when we got into those areas where children didn't have parents because they were all working, you know, and they were just floating around the streets like in South Central Los Angeles. those were difficult areas to work, and I worked them totally and completely with much fun and freedom up until the civil rights movement started in 1960. Now this became a difficult period because all of a sudden there was a total change in attitude. I was Whitey now, I wasn't Engineer Bill.
Mm-hmm. So you're restricted to certain areas?
That's right. Well, no, I still did it until at one time it got to be so bad, the commotion and the confusion and they just knocked me over and raided my van and took everything out of it, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And so I told...
Because, you know, I've done puppet shows, and I told Oscar, turned my back around, and I've had puppets just walk away. And the kids, yeah. Little kids would just pick up a puppet that you worked on for months and walk away.
I was at Florence Avenue in Compton, and the line was all organized. And the minute I drove up, the line broke, and they ran for my car. And I just opened the doors, and they knocked me down and just climbed in.
Eight, nine, 12 years old.
Yeah. There were no more than 25 adults there, and there were at least 1,000, 1,200 children.
Wow.
And so then I told Oscar Mayer, my biggest sponsor.
Jerry Marson. Jerry Marson?
No. Who was it at that time? The public relations man or the advertising man?
Wasn't he a Little Oscar for a while, though?
Oh, yeah, Jerry. Yeah, yes, yeah. Little Oscar.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I told Oscar Mayer that I would not go into any of those areas anymore unless they provided me with at least 4 security men. So they didn't ask me to go to them
anymore. Yeah, because I couldn't afford to do all
no.
that.
No.
Yeah.
So I didn't go anymore. But
you say they took things? I mean, what, their pictures that you were passing out?
Oh, candy, and toys, games, everything that I had. Everything I had, they took.
And you couldn't do really much.
No, there was nothing.
Engineer Bill really can't get mad.
No way.
You have to compose
absolutely
yourself.
Absolutely no way that you could...
get angry.
All I did was get up and run like hell for the market, out through the produce department, and I left. And my assistant brought the vehicle around.
Yeah.
So you have to get away from the situation, because if you stay, you're liable to do something that will reflect on you.
Yeah, now, to turn to the opposite end of that, there were also some beautiful experiences,
going
to hospitals. And
Did you do many hospitals? Do you know, to go to some of these market appearances, you got to come home either real happy or depressed. Because there you meet all the children. You meet the blind children. And you meet the, for instance, twins. One of them perfectly formed, a beautiful boy. The other one, a dwarf. And you meet all of nature's mistakes. And you meet the parents on whom these mistakes have been inflicted. And yet you find such beautiful people who are so proud of their children and understand that it was an error on God's part and forgive and carry the burden.
I guess depending on the parents and their upbringing, when they get up to that whistle game of yours, they're either totally petrified or they're there grasping every moment of it that they can.
That's right.
So you see them either
I'll never forget when the blind children came up. They were twins. And I had never experienced a blind child before. And all I could think of was, do you want to see me? And I grabbed the kid's hand and I let him feel my cap and face and glasses. And that's all I could think of. I didn't say, do you want to feel me? I said, do you want to see me?
Mm-hmm.
But really, there were...
And the child went right along with it.
That's right.
Used to
this is the way they do, yes. And the parents are so grateful and so happy
appreciate
that children have a chance to participate in what other children are participating.
Yeah. I think the parents are probably just as equally as as right. jazzed in meeting you as the children are, because they're all children at heart, really.
And they were fun. They were hard work. There's no question about it. When you're on the go from 7 o'clock in the morning until, and then you get home at 8 o'clock at night, mm-hmm. and your poor wife and child don't know what sort of a mood you're going to be in. Mm-hmm. And this is true.
Just a tired mood, probably.
They were true. They were very, very. They sort of felt Daddy out when he got home to see how he felt, because he had some either good experiences or bad experiences during the day.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't get the story of the driving down the freeway, because I want to get that on tape, because that was kind of funny. Did you have to deal with this? One thing is you as a face, but then, you're in that costume, and then you're in that car.
Here's that beautiful vehicle that looks like a diesel locomotive. There's no way you can hide who is in it.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.